This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. Our guests include crime writer Chuck Hustmeyer of Baton Rouge. He'll comment on the latest of his seven books, becoming a movie, Never Forgive. Chuck Hustmeyer began by writing about the case involving Antoinette Frank, a New Orleans police officer who remains on death row. People may not know, but there is a woman on death row in Louisiana. Journalist Becky Aikman tells the backstory of the making of the iconic film Thelma and Louise. The 1991 classic is the subject of her book, Off the Cliff. And Mike McClanahan, the president of the Louisiana NAACP, is slated to be with us to talk about his call for the Baton Rouge Metro Council to include only members from inside the city limits. This was the case prior to 1983. Now the news on 89.3. WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and our guest to begin is Mike McClanahan, president of the NAACP Louisiana. Since January, he succeeded Ernest Johnson, who's been with us many times, and Mike has been with us a few times, and he, along with Ernest Johnson and others, they're floating a proposal for Baton Rouge to go old school and have its own city council. Why do we need this, in your judgment?
Well, good morning, Jim. I appreciate having an opportunity to come on your show. And you're right, I feel like one of the Jim Inksters because I've been here so many times. but you're right, I like the term old school. We want to take Baton Rouge back to where it used to be, where there were but the plan, the founders of this great parish envisioned Baton Rouge, Baker, and Zachary, to which the plan of government outlines. Century was never a part of it, nor the St. George piece was never put into the plan of government. And so we want to take it back so that all cities and municipalities can have a say-so as the dollars that come in, how they go out. And who actually is the mayor, who actually has the opportunity to push and promote the Baton Rouge and East Baton Rouge Parish.
Well, as we know, since 1983, the whole parish is included on the council. And you're saying that under the new way, the new old way, that those outlying areas would not be included? Is that how it would work?
Well they would not be included in the city of Baton Rouge.
Correct.
But for the parish, they would. And so you like West Baton Rouge has a parish government too, but they also the municipalities have their own cities.
Autonomy. So you're saying we can do both?
We can do both. They're both actually operates more times than not in the state of Louisiana. There are only a few parishes that have a complete city parish form of government. Lafayette Parish tried it. I think the mayor president at the time went out against it.
But when it would come to the city of Baton Rouge, and this would mean subtracting Zachary and those areas at Baker that are outlying central, the city council, the new and you believe improved city council, would be making the decisions, correct?
Well, they would make the decisions for the city of Baton Rouge. Now, the parish form of government, those that sit on the peripheral, you know, like those that represent the central, the Zachary's, and those outlying areas, they would have a say-so in the parish form of government. But Baton Rouge would retain its autonomy.
Well, and of course, it would mean some decisions would be different, I'm sure, because the city of Baton Rouge is now majority African-American, correct?
Correct.
And there is a slight white majority for the parish.
Right.
So that makes conceivably a difference in the makeup of the council. And by virtue of the politics, probably some decisions would be different than they are now. For example, we probably would have a tolerance resolution now that we didn't have. But that's just one of many. But 877-217-5757, if you'd like to join the conversation. Mike McClanahan, along with Ernest Johnson, they wrote a piece to the Baton Rouge Advocate noting that before 1983, the city of Baton Rouge had its own city council with members elected from voting districts located within the city limits. That changed in 1983. Why did why was the change made 35 years ago?
I don't know. I wasn't really into. I don't know why the change was. But if you look back from my viewpoint, it was to the detriment of those that make up the majority. And if I may say so, I think what those that created it saw that Baton Rouge at some point would change, and the majority then would lose the majority, and they would lose their hold on what you call the power structure of Baton Rouge.
Is there anything now, for example, we have this dispute that is ongoing with a recall attempt against Tara Wicker for essentially, she did vote for Denise Amoroso to succeed her late husband Buddy on the council, and the other members, the other African-American Democrats, said they didn't want that to happen. They wanted basically to open it up. And there are disputes like that that seem to be floating every now and then. So what was the catalyst for this?
Well, the NAACP has been touting this for years. You know, this is not our first song in terms of Baton Rouge needs to have its own autonomy. I don't know what led the council members to make the decision then, but I thought it was a right move, a good move, because those of us that live inside the city of Baton Rouge have felt the power of the seven a white majority as they rule and take dollars that should be going toward our communities in North Baton Rouge and Mid-City, and they take those dollars and spread them to other places to our detriment. So it was a long time coming.
All right. Mike McClanahan with us, president of the Louisiana NAACP. He is from Zawali and has lived in Baton Rouge for a long time, though, right?
35 years.
Yeah, that's a long time. Around 1983, you came.
There you go.
David in Lafayette noticed that Lafayette City Parish Government, he says, is going through a potential change. Some want to add a second council, and there is a vote in December, he says. And here in Baton Rouge, Tracy at the Capitol asks, is this a way to thwart the St. George movement? Is this a way to basically say, look, if you want to form St. George, you're not going to have a say in what happens in downtown Baton Rouge where the action is?
I don't know. All I know is, we've spoken intimately with the people from St. George. But all I know is that we're focused on bringing Baton Rouge back to where it used to be. And whatever comes of that through the other parts of the government, that's fine. Because the plan of government only calls for three cities. It doesn't call for a St. George or a Central. It doesn't. Those are not in the plan of government. So I don't know how they came to be, but maybe it's a time to revisit all that was done illegally, mm-hmm. Against the plan of government's wishes.
John in New Road says the NAACP is spoiling for an old school white flight. Would this potentially cause the white minority in the city limits to even more move to the suburbs?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know what person's intentions, but if you just think about it, Baton Rouge is the hub of government for the entire state of Louisiana. Mm-hmm. Baton Rouge has a lot to offer. When people leave, they leave because they want to leave. There was no black flight when white were in majority. Baton Rouge existed and still does pretty well under all administrations.
All right, and another listener quickly responded by saying no need for white flight because within the city limits of Baton Rouge, there are numerous all-white neighborhoods. So, hey.
Right, right.
877-217-5757. Phil in Jefferson Parish. Hi, Phil. You're on with Mike McClanahan.
Good morning, gentlemen. I would think that the St. George proposition should be, because it's going to affect so many people, not just in East Baton Rouge Parish, but around the whole metropolitan area and even across the river, because this is also the state capital. I think more people should be involved in voting if they get to put this up for a vote. Now, these people would do anything to win, and really, they should move to Zachary. So anyway, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
This is going to, of course, ruffle some feathers. Do you think this is going anywhere, this proposal that you're offering?
Well, I tell you, there's two ways that we can get this proposal out to the voters. The council can do it on its own merit and send it to the voters, or we can get the petition of about 8,000 signatures to the council to force them to give it to the voters. So the will of the people at some point in time must be listened, must be heard.
877-217-5757 or in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. You can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. We're going to spend a bit more time with Mike McClanahan, president of the Louisiana NAACP. In his letter with Ernest Johnson, he says, "We believe the 1983 act of eliminating the Baton Rouge City Council is unfair to the citizens and voters residing within the city limits. Like Baker, Zachary, and Central, the city of Baton Rouge should be governed by its own city council." And this, you say, is an aberration from what is happening in other parts of the state.
Yeah, you know, Jim, if you think about it now, this form of government that we have is to the detriment of really the entire state and cities and counties, the parishes in which they are formed. You alluded to earlier that the gentleman said in Lafayette, they're going to bring it to a vote because they need to get rid of it. I remember a couple of years ago reading an article by the then parish president, who was from Lafayette, the mayor of Lafayette, talked about how detrimental it was to the city because the small towns really ran the parish. And this is the opportunity to run. You need to give someone like Baton Rouge, the hub of government, opportunity.
Todd in Sherwood Forest. Hello, Todd. You're on the air with Mike McClanahan.
Hey, good to talk to y'all this morning.
Hey, Todd.
I live in Sherwood Forest, and I've always thought along the lines that you do that Baton Rouge should run Baton Rouge, and East Baton Rouge Parish should have its own government agency. I grew up with the parish being different from the city, but I think this what you're proposing will help St. George, so I would support what you're doing because it'll certainly be a catalyst for St. George.
So he says it would help St. George. Well, I don't think that's what you're trying to do.
I don't know about any of that. I think the people in St. George have had it up already.
All right. 877-217-5757. Another segment coming with Mike McClanahan, president of the Louisiana NAACP, saying Baton Rouge should have its own council. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. A bit more time with Mike McClanahan, president of the Louisiana NAACP. He and his former colleague, the man who held the post before him, Ernest Johnson, wrote a letter that appeared in The Advocate a few days ago suggesting that Baton Rouge needs its own city council that would include only members from the city, not the parish, the city. And right now, as we know, Zachary and Baker and Central are all included. And Mike says this is not a consolidated government and never has been. If the government was consolidated, Central, Zachary, and Baker would not be in existence. The Baton Rouge Police Department and the East Baton Rouge Parish Sheriff's Office would be one government unit. So is this a good idea? It would probably change the makeup of the council, and right now we have a white majority in the parish, albeit a slight one, and we have a distinctive black majority in the city. How distinct is that black majority, Mike McClanahan?
Well, yeah, if I'm not mistaken, I think we are at 50, right above the 50%.
I think it's
mark.
More than that in the city.
In the city. Yeah, it's probably 60-something percent. And I think in the parish, the numbers are off, I think, 50,
it's right at 45,
it's somewhere.
It's close.
Yeah. So, but you know, Baton Rouge, if you think about it, Jim, the Baton Rouge is a unique place because it's actually one Baton Rouge parish, right? East Baton Rouge parish. And they can exist cohortly because in the scheme of things, in business and schools, they exist. But also, we'll do a lot of streamlining, right? So we need to get back to, as you call it, the old school.
All right. Katie asks if the ultimate goal is to have the mayor elected from the city limits rather than the parish.
Well, we're focusing on the council right now. Those that wish to have the mayor elected from the city and those that wish to have the parish president elected from the parish, that's fine. That's what it should look like, but we're focusing it on just the council right now.
Were you perplexed when Denise Amoroso was appointed to succeed her husband on the council, the late Buddy Amoroso?
I wasn't prepared. I've been around a long time, Jim, dealing with council business. And you know, that seat was really a Democratic seat. People want to say that it was a Republican seat. But if you look at the data and the numbers, it's actually, you know, there could have been Democratic. But, you know, people are going to be people. We just want people to govern right, people to govern with the right in their heart.
What do you make of this recall effort against Tara Wicker?
Tara's a friend of mine. You know, it kills me to see that, you know, that decision she made will affect her career. She have a star asterisk by her name from now on is being recalled, whether successful or not. And because she's done so good, I hate to see it, but I wish personally that she would have voted the way that the others were voting in terms of the black council members, so that we could have started to look at the city in a different light.
The mayor is, of course, facing the council, which is a majority of the opposition party from her. Same situation that Kip Holden had. How do you think she's faring?
Well, she's holding her own. You know, she's a fighter. She's been around a long time. Nothing really ruffles her, because if you talk to her now, she says she's Christ-centered. And when you're dealing in politics, you got to have some Christ somewhere in your life, man, too. So she's doing relatively well, saying that she has to go against, you know, 7 Republicans every time she wants to get something come out of the council.
But this 1983 act of eliminating the Baton Rouge City Council, you say, is unfair. And 35 years ago, the mayor was Patz Green. He was a liberal Democrat. You would think that he wouldn't have gone along with this unless he thought it was a good idea.
Well, I don't know what was in Patz Green's mind at the time, but those persons that were advising him had to know that at some point in time things were going to change. The story was told that one of the former mayors was rolled in a wheelchair to the council and said, "We're creating this. Do not let this change," because they talked about the power associated with the power is the dollars that come along with it. And those persons in the majority now want to continue to hold on to that power and that money.
And this is this issue of power is not only a Louisiana issue, it's a national issue. And listener Kristen asked about this controversy that is now the talk of the land about the president's former apprentice colleague, Omarosa, no relation to Buddy or Denise. She was fired, and now she's playing tapes and saying the president's a racist. What do you think?
I don't know. That's above my head, but I'm telling you, it stinks. I tell you, when you stir the pot enough, man, you get a whole lot of crap coming out of it.
Well, the president has no blacks in his inner circle, no blacks in the West Wing. I think one African-American cabinet secretary in Ben Carson. Is that reflective of America?
It's not reflective of nothing. It's not reflective of anything but his own circle of friends that he brought from his private life into the public life, because all of them came from there. If he really wanted to be reflective of America, he would appoint some Latinos, some Asians, some Africans, some blacks, some whites, some Jews, some Gentiles, some Protestants, some Catholics. That's the makeup of America.
Well, a former Metro councilman who you know well, who's been on this show a few times, is now a card-carrying Republican and a big Trump supporter, Daryl Glasper. He predicts the president, Donald John Trump, will get over 30% of the black vote in his reelection quest.
I love Daryl, and he wasn't good in math, I can tell you that, man, because I don't know how you add that up, man. You can't pour 30% of black folks on Donald Trump, even if he was a sponge.
What is it about the president that gets on the last nerve of many African Americans?
Because he doesn't talk like – he does not talk like he's a friend of us. He talked like he's a foe. He talked like he's the big boss man, and we're the slaves.
Well, he does have a habit of calling a number of black people low IQ individuals. I can think of Maxine Waters and Baton Rouge's own Don Lemon. He did not call Stormy Daniels a Baton Rougean, a low IQ individual. He slept with her. So is it because they're black, or is that just a coincidence that he would call a number of African Americans, or he would question their intelligence?
Well, he questioned their intelligence because he doesn't run in the circles. If you think about it, now he called the Omarosa lady a dog too, right?
I don't know.
He did. He called her a dog. I read it online.
Called her wacky. I don't know if he called her.
He called her a dog. He said that dog. I read it. And,
really?
And so for him to stoop that low to call it a female anyway a dog, that's kind of low life. But you know, in today's time, we haven't heard, had a president to talk about people to take the level of president to the next lowest level that you can ever take it to. And, you know, the people of America need to vote him out. His day, his days should be numbered. And he people need to let him know enough is enough.
And here's a question from Donna saying, who's smarter, President Trump or President Obama?
Look at the data. If you want to talk about IQ, the IQ people, the people who put up IQ numbers, said Obama was the smartest president
in history. How do you figure that out, though?
Those people who create data, who create questions in these matrices to determine IQ, said based upon their findings, President Obama was the smartest president ever.
All right. I've got two different emails here saying that the president did call Omarosa a dog, so if he did that, that's not something you say about anybody.
The president don't say that. We're accustomed to presidents taking a high road, using morals, and stuff. But this time, this cat, he comes out like a belly punching man from the streets in the bottom of the barrel type stuff, man. He don't care. We just need to change the title of President of the United States to anybody's office, you know, whatever. Just give it a name.
Well, this president is creating new ground. We're discussing things we would never discuss before. Who would have thought that Anderson Cooper would ask Stormy Daniels if the president used protection when they had sexual relations? That kind of thing is just not done or hasn't been done in the past. But now we're talking about things we never would have before.
With the president, the office of president was a prestige office. You know, when you walked in, people held they stopped and they took the breath and laid out the red carpet. Now, when he comes in, you know, he gonna walk on needles, pins, you know, bent up cans, because this type of guy he is. He's garbage, really. He needs to be the title man for BFI.
Well, thank you, Mike McClanahan. We'll be back soon, and we'll be back after this pause. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-57 is your number. Crime writer Chuck Hussmeier is on deck. Baton Rouge, and we'll talk about the latest of his seven books becoming a film, Never Forgive. Wrapping it up with Mike McClanahan, the president of the Louisiana NAACP. And he believes that Baton Rouge should need its own city council. Have its own city council. So what's the next step on this?
Well, the next step is to continue to roll out the petition. If the council doesn't take on its own initiative to bring this item before the voters, we'll get the required number of signatures, bring them before the council so they can bring before the voters, and let the voters have a say-so whether they want to be tied up in this form of government or whether they want to go back to old school, as you alluded to. Let's make Baton Rouge great again.
All right, and I'm looking at CNN breaking news. The president of the United States refers to ex-staffer, the only African-American to have served in a senior role in the White House, as a dog. And a listener asks, what if President Obama had only one white member on his senior staff, and they got fired, and he had referred to them as a dog, a white woman? How would that have been taken?
They would have impeached him. They had ruled at the rules of impeachment. Somebody would try to assassinate him. All that kind of stuff, man. You know that, Jim.
Well, thank you for joining us, Mike McClanahan. Appreciate
it. Thank you, Jim.
Let's
make America really great. Let's make Baton Rouge great again.
All right. We'll see you soon. Got him fired up today. And now Chuck Hussmeier, a man who served his country with distinction, and the last time he was on this program was on February 28th, which was the anniversary, the 25th anniversary of the Branch Davidian siege, and Chuck was there. He was in harm's way, almost got killed on that day, but he's stayed alive and is one of the most prolific writers in America, has written seven books over the last 15 years or so, and we've talked with him, I think, about every one of them. And his latest is about to be a movie, and this has happened before, but this one is Never Forgive. And Chuck, sometimes, as you know, when you're a writer, when your movies, one of your books becomes a movie, they tinker with it, and you may not be pleased with the outcome. But based on our conversation yesterday, I believe you're quite pleased with Never Forgive.
So far, so good, Jim, and thank you for that kind introduction. There are a lot more prolific writers than me, though.
Yeah, this is actually, this script was an original screenplay. My last two movies that I had produced were based on novels that I had written and adapted as a screen into screenplays myself. This one, I decided to cut out the middleman and just write an original screenplay. And so far, it looks good. We were on set, my wife and I, and you know, we met the star, Guy Pearce, and several of the other cast members and crew, and it looks like they're doing a good job.
Now, previously, one of your books was made into a film starring Steven Seagal. I gathered that you were not all that enamored with Mr. Seagal.
That would be an understatement, yes. My last movie, which is my second movie, was called End of a Gun. That wasn't my title. The producer picked that. And the producer also picked the star, Steven Seagal. And a lot of our fellow Louisianians know him from his sort of impromptu appearance during Katrina when he was all fitted out in SWAT gear. And then later, before Katrina, he started some kind of a reality TV show down in Jefferson Parish called Lawman. And, I wasn't very impressed with him on set. We filmed that movie in Bucharest, Romania, and it was pretty bad. I can't even watch the movie myself, actually.
Does he still have the ponytail?
Yes, he does, and he travels with a hair guy, so I don't exactly know what goes on with that ponytail, but anyway, he's quite a different kind of guy. That's all I can say. He's difficult.
Yeah, of course, he at one time was a big star and has had a controversial personal background. But this Guy Pearce fellow, why do you like him?
Guy Pearce is a true professional. I mean, watching him work is the polar opposite of watching Steven Seagal work. I mean, this for Guy Pearce, my movie is a relatively, low on the totem pole. This is about a $3 million movie, and... But you wouldn't know it by watching him. I mean, he talks to the director before every scene that's being shot. He's going over what he's going to be saying. He's trying to figure out what his character would or should be doing. I mean, he rehearses. He just does everything you would expect a professional actor to do. And I've seen several professional actors, and not all of them act like that. So, I mean, he's just a very professional and thorough craftsman. And also, when my wife Christy and I talk to him, on set between shots, he's just a really nice person. I mean, you just walk up to him and start talking. He's just very friendly.
And you've had three produced movies, haven't you?
Yes. House of the Rising Sun, End of a Gun, and then this one, Never Forgive. They've all, they've all gone through title. Well, except for the first one. House of the Rising Sun was my title. I stuck with it, but then they filmed it in Grand Rapids, Michigan during a blizzard, so... kind of knocked out the whole New Orleans angle. End of a Gun was also set originally in New Orleans, and they filmed in Romania. Mm-hmm. So I decided to quit picking places. So on this one, I just sort of picked a small town in the middle of nowhere, and the producer settled on Horse Cave, Kentucky, as the location to film it.
Horse Cave, Kentucky.
Right, and I swear I thought it was a fake name. When they sent me the script back and they had changed all the slug lines where the locations are to Horse Cave, I wrote the producer. I said, that's the dumbest name of a town I've ever heard. Who made that up? And he wrote back and he said, that's the real name, I swear. So we went to Horse Cave. Yeah, Christy and I. It was fun.
Do they have horse T-shirts there?
No. The horse, well, if you've seen the... I brought my own T-shirts. All right, there's a story behind that. I brought the... Guy Pearce, the director, York Shackleton, the producer, Dan Grodnick, and several other people, these black T-shirts, and I had an old high school buddy of mine's wife print on them, there's a horse and a question mark. And I have that same saying tacked over my workspace here, my desk, where I write my scripts, because that producer had that script under option for a year and a half, and we were talking about casting it, and I said, look, Dan, whoever you get, guy's got to be able to ride a horse. And he goes, why? I said, well, at the end, there's a big shootout, and the hero's on a horse, and he's facing off of these bad guys on motorcycles. And he goes, there's a horse? I'm like, yeah. If you had read the script any time in the last year and a half that you're making, you would know that. And it's just proof that what all screenwriters know, producers don't read scripts.
Well, after three of his works becoming films, Chuck has claimed the title, and I'm in concurrence, the screenwriting king of Baton Rouge. He will forevermore be known on this program as the screenwriting king of Baton Rouge, although we both note that the bar is somewhat low. Steven Soderbergh began here 30 years ago with Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Chuck, sometimes it's not a case of overnight you being an overnight sensation, but overnight recognition. And I've also been told that you've got another one in the works called Bullet Train.
Yeah, I do. By the way, I said that screenwriting king of Baton Rouge sort of tongue in cheek there, Jim. You know that.
But I think anyway, it fits. I think it fits.
Anyway, a producer is right now working on casting a movie that I wrote called Bullet Train, which they say they're going to film in Hungary. And the same producer who made Never Forgive is making another script of mine called Relentless, which we'll probably shoot in Thailand or some other exotic overseas location. So, I try to write myself. My wife and I had a little tiny part in Never Forgive, and I have a little tiny part with her in Relentless, but I can't figure out how to put myself on a 500-mile-an-hour bullet train going from Paris to Shanghai.
Well, your first book was about Antoinette Renee Frank, a former New Orleans police officer convicted of the murder of three people. And it was in March of 95 that Frank and her accomplice, Rogers Lacaze, committed a violent armed robbery at a restaurant. And she, Antoinette Frank, who you profiled in your book, is on death row in Louisiana, has been there for some time. And quite often I'll see stories about the people on death row in Louisiana, and they'll count up all the people at Angola, and they'll forget about Antoinette Frank. And I've done that myself, by the way. But is there any possibility that this woman who is incarcerated at St. Gabriel at the Louisiana Correctional Institute for Women will ever be executed?
I would not bet on it, Jim. I don't know why I say that, but we're in the Deep South, and I just don't see the authorities in Louisiana executing a woman, no matter how heinous her crimes. So she's been on there 20 something, almost 30 years now, and I just don't see it.
Your book, Killer with a Badge, brought new attention to this case. It was a particularly heinous crime, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, they murdered another police officer whom Antoinette Frank worked with every day. They murdered two innocent people in the kitchen, part of the family that owned the restaurant. I mean, they just shot them to pieces. I mean, it wasn't just, it was heinous. That's a good way to describe it.
Well, the other assailant, though, is not on death row.
Right, Rogers Lacaze, he won some type of appeal, but then that was immediately overturned and his conviction reinstated. However, there's some procedural thing that's far above my pay grade, so to speak, to figure out, but his death sentence was not reinstated. There would have been some extra steps involved. They would have had some type of hearing, a court appearance, and drag a lot of these family members back into court 20-something years later, and the DA just said, okay, we'll go with life without parole. So he's convicted of three counts of first-degree murder, serving life without parole now, and I assume they moved him from the death row to general population or whatever.
The first of seven books written by Chuck Hussmeier. There are more coming, but this one was Killer with a Badge, and we'll talk with him some more after we pause. Your number is 877-217-5757. We're back after this brief timeout for more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar are producing, and a few more minutes with Chuck Hussmeier, a Baton Rougean who's done very well as a crime writer, and he was a federal agent for many years. How long were you a federal agent, Chuck?
I was with ATF for 13 years, and I spent about 8 years before that with local law enforcement.
And you wrote your first book, and the others that have followed have also had crime themes, but this one was Killer with a Badge, and it made a big impression about Antoinette Frank, the former New Orleans police officer who was involved in the killing of three people and is on death row. She's serving time in St. Gabriel, and I haven't heard much about her lately. Obviously, when people go away for crimes committed, there isn't a whole lot of media attention on her cell in St. Gabriel. But nonetheless, what a fascinating story. How does somebody have this kind of evil to conduct a crime, as you say, that involved innocent people who were slaughtered and an officer that she knew quite well?
You know, I've been asking myself that since I started working on the book back in the early 2000s. You know, I just don't know what it was about her, whether she just had some, you know, she just snapped, or there was something lurking in her the whole time. I suspect it was the latter, because she did, in her application process, fail both the psychological and the psychiatric evaluations. She managed to exploit a loophole in the system that they used for hiring back then, and still managed to get herself appointed a police officer in New Orleans. So there were clearly warning signs, but they were pretty much ignored back in the crime-ridden days of the 90s.
And a listener says this restaurant where this tragedy occurred, it's still open. Is that correct?
It was open several years ago. I think the Vu family, they continued to operate it for years after the tragedy there, but I think they have moved to Metairie or Kenner or somewhere and opened up some other type of business. But it was open, you know, when I was writing research and writing the book several years after the crime, and the Vus were still operating at that time.
Yeah, stayed open some time after this tragedy. But, Chuck, good luck on Never Forgive. When will this be available for viewing from listeners?
I suspect it will be about 8 months to a year. I mean, movies take a while for post-production and distribution and all. But, you know, with a star like Guy Pearce, you know, I'm hoping it will get some, at least some kind of publicity when it starts to come out. But I suspect next spring or summer.
Well, congratulations on your continuing success, and let's talk again soon. Thank you, Chuck Hustmeyer. Appreciate it.
All right, Jim. Thank you.
See you. And we're joined now by Becky Eggman. She's the author of the memoir Saturday Night Widows, The Adventures of Six Friends Remaking Their Lives. She was a journalist at Newsday. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. She lives in Brooklyn, and her latest work is about the 1991 classic Thelma and Louise, Off the Cliff, a delicious blow-by-blow account, according to the BBC. This is a movie that those of us of a certain vintage remember well. It's been 27 years now. It made Brad Pitt a star, but the two big stars in the film were female, in Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. And you say this off the cliff, that the making of Thelma and Louise, Becky, it drove Hollywood to the edge. It drove Hollywood to the same edge almost as the two main characters. What happened?
Well, then as now, unfortunately, it was really, really rare to have a movie starring two women and having them act out in the way that these two got to act out. So it was a real long shot that this movie would make it through the system and get made. The people working on it were real underdogs, and I thought it would be a fun and exciting story to tell how that happened, because it is so rare, and maybe we could learn from that how other interesting, unusual, fresh projects could get done.
Well, when it was made, I'm sure there was no idea what it would become, and it was an immediate hit, earning 6 Academy Award nominations, but the years since have produced even more acclaim for Thelma and Louise. What was it about the film that made it so special?
Well, it was so unusual. Gina Davis said to me the kinds of parts that were usually available to her were what she called the good luck, honey, parts, where the woman was the girlfriend and stood around in the background while the guys had all the adventures. This was a movie where women really got to drive the story. They even got to drive the car. And it was about their concerns, and they controlled the plot. And it was a fresh and exciting thing for women and men in the audience to see a movie that broke the mold that way.
And we just visited with a talented writer, Chuck Hustmeyer. The writing in this film also was a significant part of its success, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. And what's funny about it is that many of the key people involved in this movie had no idea what they were doing. So that's one reason it feels so fresh. The writer was Callie Curry. She was a 30-year-old former waitress and college dropout who was working behind the scenes making music videos. She threw all of her frustration about her own thwarted ambition into writing this screenplay about women who want to break out of the constraints of society. She told me she wasn't writing the kind of movie that got made. She was writing the movie she wanted to see. It was a real triumph in the end for her. It was the first thing she'd ever written, but it went on to win the Oscar. And it was the first time in 60 years that a woman writing without a male partner won the Oscar for Best Original Screenplay.
Well, it's a classic, no doubt, and has been lauded as such. And I suspect that people will be talking about Thelma and Louise long after you and I are gone. But your book has brought new attention to it, and the stars did very well after Thelma and Louise.
Well, it put Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis on the map in a way they hadn't been before and made them symbols for a lot of people. They told me that anytime they go anywhere, people rush up to them and tell them how much Thelma and Louise meant to them. So they really enjoy that they got to play such significant characters. Gina Davis now actually runs an institute to try to get more roles for women in Hollywood and more movies made with women in leading roles. And Susan Sarandon has gone on and had a long career of significant parts. So they did well. They were unusual in that Gina Davis was 32 and Susan Sarandon was 40 when they made it. And there weren't many parts for women past the age of the mid-20s at the time. So they felt really lucky to get these roles, which every star in Hollywood was lobbying to play.
Roger Ebert loved the film, but he did say it's unsettling to get involved in a movie that takes 128 minutes to bring you to a payoff that the filmmakers seem to fear. Certainly the ending was provocative.
The ending was controversial from the beginning. Every studio but one in Hollywood turned down the script, even though they all loved it. I mean, it's very funny, it's full of action, it's very entertaining, but they turned it down partly because there were two women characters who they didn't think would be a draw at the box office. But a lot of it had to do with that polarizing ending, and it was a tough one. Throughout the production, they kept debating how strongly to go with it. Roger Ebert's review, he felt that they were timid. Most people didn't feel that way. In fact, at the first test screening, the audience hated the movie and hated the ending. And afterwards, the filmmakers sat around thinking, oh, how do we redo everything? And they decided they should stay with the original intention. And they actually took out one shot that had softened the ending a bit to make it stronger. And at the next test screening, the audience went crazy and loved it. So I think they were bolder than many filmmakers would have been. And they never saw the ending as the women killing themselves. They saw it as more symbolic. They wanted it to be seen as these were two women who were escaping a world that was too small to contain them, that they were finding a kind of freedom in the great beyond. Mm-hmm. So some people looked at it that way. Some people found it shocking and depressing. It got everybody talking at the time, which was part of what powered the popularity of the film.
Becky, even though the film certainly salutes to wonderful characters at Sarandon and Gina Davis, and was considered to be cutting edge, did it really change the environment that much for women in Hollywood?
No, it really didn't. At the time, everyone said, now Hollywood will really recognize there's an audience for serious films with serious roles for women. But it didn't change all that much, and still hasn't changed all that much. Consistently, throughout all these years, less than a third of all movies women have less than a third of all the speaking parts in movies, and less than 20% have women in the lead. So it's still very unusual. It's still a tiny number of women who direct films and write films. So it's frustrating that it hasn't changed much. Everyone keeps thinking this is the moment. And after Wonder Woman last year did so well, I think a lot of people think maybe this really is the moment. So one reason I did my book now is to show how this can really happen, and maybe everybody can see from this, here's a path for how to make a movie like that a success.
Well, it's a remarkable account of the 1991 classic, Thelma and Louise, Off the Cliff, How the Making of Thelma and Louise Drove Hollywood to the Edge, from our guest, Becky Aikman. Thank you, Becky. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, for me too. Thanks.
We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Becca Dill and Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.